If you look in the Sedras, the parshas of the Torah that are being read this week, last week, a week before, you see there's a fascinating subject that has to be understood. It so happens that it's the subject of the nature of evil. Don't need too much imagination to understand that that's the topic, that's what's happening, that's what has to be understood. You have to understand that what we're supposed to be doing is bringing goodness to the world. That's what we're supposed to be doing. The job that we've been given as a people is to bring into the world, is to force the channels in such a way, to force the spiritual flow in such a way that what could be evil turns out to be good. That's what we're supposed to be doing here. And we're going to be squeezed into doing that by the most ruthless forces of evil that will be ranged against us. We have to understand that it's not a theoretical idea. There's a lot of people out there who want us dead. That means you and me. It's not 8,000 miles away. There are a lot of people, if you could call them that, more than we number, who want us dead right now. They're not bothered by the ruthlessness or the cruelty that would be involved. Wouldn't bother them at all. Not only that, but they are prepared to give their lives for it. They wouldn't do it in a cowardly way. If necessary, they would give their lives for that. There's a force of evil that's set up in the world whose job it is to kill us, even if it means their death. But that's a special subject we've touched on before. But this force considers it its duty in the world, invested in certain people and peoples, to kill us and eradicate us from the world. If they were able to, they would snuff out your life immediately. It wouldn't take not a second thought. It wouldn't flinch at all. On the contrary, they'd sense elation at doing it. We have to understand that while they're to blame, there's no question, but from a higher dimension, that force is being poured out into the world in order to get us to do what we're supposed to be doing. Actually, the ultimate blame for that is us. You have to understand that. The prevention of such a thing and the response to such a thing is purely spiritual work. If we tried to explain last night for those who were here, I'm not going to go through it again, that there are two Jewish responses to such a situation. One is a physical violent response, and one is to desist from violence and work only spiritually. That means turn inward and become what we're supposed to be. Each individual working on himself, working on his personality, refining himself, becoming. We're supposed to be beacons of nobility and refinement. We're supposed to spread out to a family. Can't afford an angry word now. We can't afford a harmful, negative word about another Jew. Can't afford that now. That's what we're supposed to be doing. And if we don't do it, the forces against us are going to be... Right now we've seen the beginning of forces that have been deflected away from us miraculously. But if we don't wake up, then that deflection is going to stop happening. Not only that, but it could be that the balance of forces could turn very, very unexpectedly. And not only far away. The same forces that want to do the damage that they're trying to do right now have a lot of sympathizers right here. There are a lot of sympathizers everywhere. When such a force gains the upper hand, a lot of people join them. If we think we're sitting idly by to watch something that's going on someplace else, it's a terrible, tragic mistake. If we are situated in a position where we have some relative peace compared to others of our close relatives who don't have such peace, then we're expected to do a harder job than they, because we're not being pressured into it. We have to make tremendous changes in our lives. And there's guidance here. A person has to know exactly in which areas to begin and not to put it off. Let's try and understand from a Torah point of view, unrelated to the present situation, let's understand the root of some of the idea of forces of evil, how it relates to what the Torah talks about right now, and how to understand what it is we're supposed to do. It's a very, very frightening sugya. Very, very frightening. You'll see that from the deepest sources, there's an abject terror associated with the situation. Not unreal. Evil is unreal in the world, but the terror of that unreality is very real. There's a promise that we'll survive. We'll laugh in the end and we'll survive, but it doesn't necessarily mean you personally, it doesn't mean me personally. Collectively it means, but how many of us will be there to see it, and what we'll have to go through to get there is very, very unclear. Unfortunately, it's very clear in some ways. Number one. Number two is that this subject is very difficult to discuss, first of all because of the terror involved. Secondly, because in the mystical writings it says that when you discuss the subject of evil, you give it power. When we discuss the structure, how the worlds of negativity are all set up, then what happens is we stimulate those worlds, a remarkable thing. In the mystical writings, there's a tradition that a person shouldn't even mention the name of certain forces, certain angels, certain parts of the spiritual structure, the cosmic pattern. Great mystics, I once had the experience of being able to learn some superficial aspect of this subject with a very great man in Yerushalayim. And if we were learning a text together, and the first time we came across the Hebrew word for the shells, you know, in the mystical language, the dimension of evil is referred to as the outer shells. He didn't pronounce the word. He said the first two letters and he wouldn't say the word. And I asked him and explained to me that if you even just say the word of certain dimensions of negativity, what happens is the forces that are in control, the forces that are that are embodied in those dimensions, what happens is they start to get excited. The mechanism, the reason is that there is a force built into the creation that transcendent emissaries, transcendent forces, angels, various other forces like that, they draw their power from an external source. It's what's called yunika. Yunika means suckling. They suckle from a higher source. But they have to suckle from a source of genuine power, because they themselves, all forces of evil, actually in themselves are nothing. They in themselves are just shells. The life force inside of them comes from a real life source. And so they're always looking to suckle from a correct and valid life source. So when a person who is a source of purity even mentions their name, they think they're going to be allowed to suckle from his spiritual light. And therefore, no, I'll subject. And therefore they start to get excited and they start to vibrate power into the worlds. And therefore, one has to be very, very careful what one's allowed to say, so as not to give them power. It doesn't take much to see that they already have plenty. So we don't need to add to that. So let's try and discuss it in a way that's permitted and understand some very deep issues. The way we approach the subject is as follows. Are there not chairs for you? You're going to make me uncomfortable standing. Huh? Maybe you could all just move a bit forward so they can fit inside. If you look in the sages, you'll see the very strange idea. Now, this is a set of ideas which, first of all, are hard to understand in their own right. But the problem is, as we've discussed many times at these meetings, our concepts of what Torah is, of what Judaism is, are so Christological, is so secular, is so anti-Jewish, that at the best of times it's impossible to understand the spiritual depth in them. But in these areas you'll see that the problems amplify. You see in the Seder you have a very strange set of events. And all these events go around a stick, a piece of wood. Right? What's called the Mate Elohim. Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, holds in his hand a staff. You've noticed that. From childhood, you know. He carries around a staff, and this stick, this mate, does strange things. Able to influence the nature, splitting of the sea, miracles are performed. He throws it on the ground, it becomes a snake, some sort of terrifying snake, a primal snake, not just a snake. A snake that's so terrifying that he runs away from it. He goes into Paro's court, and there's a whole competition over there. Aaron throws his down, and they throw theirs, and he swallows that, and they swallow this. A show. You know, the way we interpret, we sort of get some kind of picture, like at the level of a six-year-old's birthday party, where they invite someone along to change one thing into another. That's how we sort of see it. Competition. Moshe Rabbeinu tries to impress them with this. Paro's not impressed. He can do the same trick. What exactly is going on? That tiny piece of Chumash, the fact that he holds a stick in his hand, a staff, in the mystical writings, some of the deepest secrets of the world and the deepest secrets of the world of evil are connected with an understanding of what that thing is. Let's try and undo the way we think about these things, and let's try and understand something of them. First of all, let's just try and feel out how far this thing goes. First of all, this object is called a mate. A mate in Hebrew has remarkable meanings. First of all, it means a stick, it means a staff. But it has other remarkable meanings. One is it means a tribe. Right? Mate Ephraim, Mate Yehuda, the tribe of Judah, it means a tribe also. What's the connection? We know in Hebrew, if two things are referred to by the same term, it means they are the same thing. What on earth is the connection between this object and a tribe of Israel? In fact, if you think about it further, I see a few Israelis here, if you think about anyone who speaks Hebrew, you think about it a bit further, you'll see that in case you think it's coincidental, there is another word for a stick in Hebrew, and that word also means a tribe. In case you think Hebrew is accidental, system of grunts and groans that people evolved over a couple of million years, like other languages have a large dose of, there's a word in Hebrew called the shevet. Shevet means a staff or a scepter, means the same thing, and it also means a tribe. Now, they can't miss that fact. If the two words in the holy language that express a certain physical object both happen to mean the same two things, that's a remarkable thing that has to be understood. That's one thing that we have to understand. Second problem we have to understand is, what did he need anything in his hand for? The miracles are being done by emanations from a transcendent level that are coming down and performing whatever has to be performed. Does it make any difference if he holds a stick in his hand? Why did he have to hold anything in his hand? Why did he have to even do anything? Why did he have to carry around this piece of wood? And it had remarkable functions. At a certain point, they had to plant it in the ground. Do you remember that? All the tribes had to plant their staff in the ground. And Aaron's staff grew almond blossoms. Same staff. The same Mate Elohim. What was it needed for? Further, when you see what actually happened to it, it's very hard to understand. Let's go through it carefully and understand, try to avoid that six-year-old insight, lack of it, and understand what happened. Moshe Rabbeinu is speaking to Hashem. Hashem says to him, what do you have in your hand? He says, a staff. Hashem's calling his attention to the fact that he's holding this. Hashem says to him, throw it on the ground, because Moshe Rabbeinu says that people won't believe me. What sign will I have that I'm saying the truth, that I'm a prophet? And that what I'm saying will come to pass. Hashem says, because I'm going into a dimension, I'm going into Egypt. I'm going into the place which is the seat of evil. If there's one place on earth where my purity is not going to count for anything, it's going to be there. How am I going to convince them that I am a source of truth? Hashem says to him, what's in your hand? He says, a staff. Hashem says to him, throw it on the ground. So he throws it on the ground and it becomes some kind of primeval, primal force of negativity so powerful that Moshe Rabbeinu ran away. You have to understand the depth of that. It says that he was so frightened, he was so afraid, that he ran. You have to understand, Moshe Rabbeinu is the greatest man alive, who has a completely clear vision of reality. He knows that anything evil is non-existent. There were people, you have to understand this, you have to understand that there were people in the last generation who were able to focus on the true construction of the world so powerfully that miracles happened all around them. Many witnesses saw. Many, many, many stories. The Brisker Rav was traveling through Eastern Europe. Many, many stories. One occasion, when he came to a certain border, the German guards stopped them and they didn't have papers. And it meant death. As they were about to examine the papers, three men on horseback rode up out of the mist, dressed in the uniform, this is the First World War, dressed in the Kaiser's general's uniforms, and ordered them to let them through. The Riskarov, meantime, was standing off on the side, and he was just mumbling something to himself. The men disappeared, and they were allowed through. After they passed through, people asked the Rav, what happened? There were no men. There were no horsemen. There were no horses. There wasn't anything. But what the Germans perceived were these apparitions. They asked the Brisker of what he was doing. He said, all I was doing was saying to myself, I ain't made nobody, that's all. I was saying there's nothing besides Hashem, that's all. I thought it was appropriate time to say that. And I was saying to myself, I ain't made nobody, there's nothing besides Hashem. When he focused on that reality that strongly, the world turned itself upside down. And that's a clear tradition the Nefesh HaChaim says, not in the... This is an open source that anybody has access to. He says that if a person can focus powerfully enough on that thought, in a time of danger... If a person, he says this openly, it's not a book in which he gives you mystical spells and incantations. It's a book, straightforward Torah work. And he goes so far as to say, and he wasn't a Hasid, he wasn't from the Hasidic line, or people who deal more openly with the esoteric secrets. He says quite clearly, if a Jew will be in trouble, and he will focus in his mind on the thought that there's nothing besides Hashem's reality, then that's all that will exist and he cannot come to any harm. That's what he says. You can't play games with this. You have to lift yourself to the level where you mean that, to where you understand that. It takes a lifetime's training. It takes a lifetime of purification. But if a person can do that, that's what happens. Moshe Rabbeinu was on a level that so far surpasses what we're talking about here that we can't begin to conceive what it was. If anybody was totally confronting the reality of Hashem's presence all the time, it was he. So he couldn't learn any lessons about that. That means he knew where the Emes was all the time. He was completely in contact with it. And yet when this stick turned into a snake or a serpent or whatever it was, he was so terrified in the presence of Hashem. You have to understand, he was talking to the creator of the universe. And in the middle of that conversation, he sees something which is nothing at all. And it's a crude trick that's going to be used to impress some Egyptians. But he finds it so terrifying that he can't stand in his place. He runs away. Hashem says to him, pick it up by its tail. Never mind running away. Pick it up by its tail. So Moshe Rabbeinu picks it up by its tail and it turns back into a staff in his hand. That is supposed to turn the Egyptians around. But the fact that it fell on the floor, what happens? He goes into Egypt and he does it. He arrives with Aaron. He stands in the court of Pharaoh and he says, God sent me. And I've come to tell you, this is this week's Seder, last week's Seder, this week's Seder. You can read it in detail. Hashem sent me to tell you to let the Jewish people go. So Pharaoh says, who's Hashem? I don't know him. So Moshe and Aaron decide to prove to Pharaoh who they are, what their credentials are. So they throw their stick on the ground, and it becomes this terrifying, awesome tanin, snake, whatever it is, some kind of reptile. So Pharaoh says, that's nothing. Pharaoh laughs at them. It says in Midrash that Pharaoh laughed. You have to understand the scene. To picture the scene for a moment. Moshe Rabbeinu walks into the palace. Just picture in your mind's eye what happened. Moshe Rabbeinu stands 10 amas tall. That's about 5 meters. Moshe Rabbeinu is 5 meters tall. Paro, it says in Midrash, was 2 or 3 tefachim high. Paro was about that high. Okay? Explains in some mystical sources, it means he was pure intellect, pure spiritual power. That's what he was. Negativity, but pure throbbing power spiritually. That's who ruled Egypt. He had the Egyptians believing that he created himself. He created the Nile and he created himself. He performed these physical bodily ablutions in the Nile River each day so that no one would ever suspect that he used the bathroom. That was his genius, but he had them fooled. You get evil genius.
it can stand in the face of tremendous power. He's sitting on his throne, and he has at the entrance to his palace a number of systems that keep anyone who shouldn't be there out. First of all, he has untamed lions. He has ferocious, man-eating lions and other wild animals gathered around the gate. And the doorway into his throne room is very low, says the Midrash, so that anyone walking in has to bow down to walk through, so that automatically he'll be bowing down to Paro. No choice about it. The Moshe and Aaron have to walk through this, right, in order to make their point. So they walk straight through the animals, and the lions start licking their feet. Here's the Midrash. They start purring like kittens and licking their feet. And as they approach the doorway, it suddenly raises itself to the height of Moshe Rabbeinu. Didn't have to bend his head at all. Paro's not impressed at all, by the way. He comes from a place where this is their business, this kind of thing. He doesn't say he was impressed. He had lots more guts left. You have to understand this. In case you think that people who are gifted with evil genius are given to surrender at the first pop of a cracker, it's not the way it goes. Their tendency is not to surrender until their whole country and empire have been smashed into powder. And even then they've still got some guts left. I have to understand that very carefully. It doesn't matter what they take with them. I don't have to be too explicit to them. Not to underestimate. They approach Paro, and in order to prove their credentials, they throw this thing on the ground. The Midrash says that Paro started laughing. He said to them incredulously, "You are trying to impress me with this trick? You've come to the place on earth where that's our specialty. We invented that trick." That's what it says in Midrash. And it says that Paro got all his advisors to do the same thing. All the people standing around. Can you imagine the scene? Here's Moshe Rabbeinu, the Jew, member of a slave people. He walks in, and imagine the bitterness. You have to understand the bitterness. The anger, the bitterness of Paro was that this was the man that he brought up in his own house unknowingly. It says in Mephoshim and in mystical sources that the final showdown between good and evil always is ironic. That's what it says. Paro's destruction came after he made a decree to kill every male baby, every Jewish male child he had destroyed. And while his people were out searching for every male child to throw in the river, he was busy growing in his own home. He was busy feeding and suckling on his knee the child who had destroyed. That's always how evil is destroyed. You have to understand this. It doesn't look funny while it's happening. It looks funny afterwards. It doesn't look funny while you're going through it. But you have to understand that and have a sense of irony in Jewish history. That's what happened. This child that he cradled on his knee, says on his knee, says in Midrash once that Moshe Rabbeinu, when he was a baby, reached out for Paro's crown and he took it off his head, and his advisor said to him, "This child's going to usurp you one day. That's a sign." They had that sensitivity and insight, and Paro disregarded it because he put him to a test, and the test proved his way. But imagine the scene now. He comes face to face with a man whom he generated. Now, his own daughter brought this man up in his own home. He walks in now with all the spiritual power of the world at his disposal. And when he's about to try and impress Paro, what happens is he does a trick. That's the least in the book. He does a trick. So Paro says to him, in relief, he says to him, "You're trying to impress me with that?" And he has all these people do the same thing. And now this whole, imagine the scene, the place is swimming with these reptiles, crawling. And then it says, Paro wasn't happy with that. He wanted to really make his point. So he called in his wife, it says. And he had her do the same thing. He called his wife in, wherever she was, in the royal kitchen or giving orders someplace, whatever. Whatever she did. She took a stick and she threw it on the ground and it became the same thing. And Paro was enjoying it heartily, it says. And then it says he called in the school children. Tinoikos mi beis askoli shelahem, it says. He called in the school children. Kids, children, 4, 5, and 6 years old. And the kids trooped in with their sticks and they threw them on the ground and they became snakes. So Paro was making a mockery of Moshe Rabbeinu. He was saying to him, "You try to impress me with the trick." The Midrash actually says it's like bringing straw to a place where they make straw. "We're the world center of this commodity, and you're trying to sell it to us." And that was the tone, that was the mood. What happens eventually? In order to prove who they are, Aaron's stick swallows up theirs. The snake, when Aaron threw his staff to the ground and it became a snake, it went around and swallowed up theirs. But it says that two miracles happened. Nais b'seich nais, says Rashi. One miracle was that it swallowed the others up. But more miraculous was, it swallowed them while in the form of a staff. It didn't swallow them while it was a snake. It first turned itself back into a staff. And while it was a piece of wood, it went and swallowed up their snakes. And then there was silence. Now, this has to be understood. You know? This has to be understood. There's no jokes in Midrash. Torah is not there to entertain the children on Shabbos. You know? Does that also, but it has to have a dimension that goes to the root of the creation. Let's try and understand a little bit what this is. It's a very, very deep and difficult subject. Let's try a little bit to understand. The root of the word mate, we won't be able to go through the subject in detail. We'll try and just give a guideline about what it means, evil in the world. If you want to see the source of this, the most accessible source you can read, you can look in the Sefer called Das Tumas. In English it's called the Knowing Heart. It's been translated. It doesn't have any Kabbalistic terms. It's pure Kabbalistic information. But it's translated, it was written in non-Kabbalistic language. You can read in that book a discussion of many other things that a person needs to know at this juncture in history. You dare not put it off a day. But in addition to everything else, this subject is discussed over there. And with this background, it should be easier to understand. I'm not saying that book's easy to understand. It was written by one of the greatest mystics of the last 300 years. But a person can look over there. The word mate in Hebrew, which means a staff, and it means a tribe, the essential root meaning of that word is to bend. It means to bend away. Note in Hebrew, noite, means to lean out from center, means to angle out. That's the word mate. Try and understand. In the mystical writings it says that the world was created by the heavens being bent. You hear well. Describes the event of the creation of the physical world as follows. That the heavens, which doesn't mean the sky, it means the spiritual dimension of purity, was in existence. As that world came into existence, what happened was there was a bend in the creation, and that dimension bent itself downwards. They're all figurative. It's literal, 100% literal, but it's not physical also. But not the way you have a picture. You're not allowed to have a picture of these things. You have to understand it in the mind's eye above where they're pictures. Now these are the words. The spiritual dimension bent itself down and became the physical. It means that the physical world is the result of having bent the spiritual world. That's called netiya. That's what it's called. Netiya shamayim v'yeis hadayis. Bends the heavens and founds the world. Try and understand the concept. Why this is dealt with in the authoritative commentaries is for the following reason. Keep that idea in mind and let's understand the problem. The problem is not the psukim in Tanakh, in Chumash, like we're talking. The problem is, how does evil arise in the world? The problem that they all deal with, right, is the most difficult question of all. Based on this question is why good people suffer, why inexplicable things happen in the world, all kinds of suffering. They're all small branches of this big subject. And the subject is, how does a creator, who is all good and only good, end up with a world that has such horrific badness in it? How does that happen? Because we know that everything he does is good, but it certainly doesn't look like it. We have an emunah, a faith, that everything that he is and does is good and goodness, and only to give and do goodness. But we don't see that here. We're not supposed to fool ourselves that this is good. Ultimately we'll see how it's good, but right now, no way you can call it good right now. How does that happen? We have a principle that says, Ein ra yored milamala. Evil does not come down from above. Evil doesn't come down from above. That means above, in the spiritual world, only goodness. So now what's going on? That means that up in the spiritual world, which is the source of this world, there's only goodness. In this world, there's plenty of badness. And yet it doesn't come from there. So where does it come from? There's nothing else in the world. And there's only Hashem. You begin to hear the problem. No? You're not going to enjoy the answer unless you hear the problem. You must have thought about it. How does evil get generated in a world that is an embodiment of the Creator's goodness? It's a fascinating and most intensely difficult problem. And I'm sure everything we can say about it is far from an answer. But the way that our great sages have led, the pathway that they've taken to understand the subject, to begin to understand or to understand what we can't understand, is this discussion. And it has to do with the bending of the spiritual world to form the physical. Try and understand. Let's try and understand. if you really think about it, you'll see that not only is there evil in the world, but in the mystical sources it says that there's almost only evil in the world. Now, I've been very cautious, you have to understand that. After the sin, after Adam did what he did, it says in sources, there are sources that say, that the world was not successful in its project. The world was set down here, bent into existence, in order to achieve a certain end. The world never achieved that end. That means, it never arrived at a situation of peaceful existence, not even for one night. That's what it says. There wasn't one night in the history of the world. In case you think in your personal life you might have suffered suffering or tragedy, right? It says in the sources that Hashem, in his relationship with the world, hasn't had nachas. He hasn't had nachas from the world, not for one night. You trace your course through Jewish history, and you'll see, apart from the generations of torture, apart from the butchery and torture that we've undergone, apart from that, but the world in general, the day the world was created, it says, Adam Arishon, the dust was gathered together at the 10th hour in the morning. The 11th hour it was shaped into the shape of a man. At the 12th hour it was life was breathed in, and he was a human being. At the 11th, at the next hour, 1 o'clock in the afternoon if you like, the 13th hour, he sinned. The next hour he was judged, the next hour he was exiled from the garden. He didn't make it to Shabbos. He was created at midday. He awoke. His consciousness entered him at midday on Friday, and before Shabbos he was already, had crashed the world into this disaster. Not one night did the world enjoy of the way it was supposed to be. And every chance of perfection that the world had was crashed into evil. They go through it in detail. When was the next chance? There was a chance that the world had when the Torah was given. When the Jews stood at Sinai and they received the Torah, all the mystical sources say it was a marriage. We stood under the chuppah with Hashem. We stood marrying God. He was the young groom. We were the young bride. We followed him through the desert. And we stood under the chuppah at Sinai. At that moment of chuppah, of wedding, it says that the seeds of the sin of the golden calf were being formed in the minds of the Jews. It's like a bride who committed an immoral act, an act of immoral relationship under the chuppah, is what it says. That's how we work. You have to understand, it means a millionth of a millionth of a millionth of a millionth of that consciousness, but it was there. Which means that the perfection that ensued was very, very short-lived before we crashed it. Before Moshe Rabbeinu arrived with the tablets, before he came down with the concretization of this relationship, we already blew it. Not one night did we live in the world of the Luchos that he brought down to us. When Shlomo HaMelech built the Beis HaMikdash, I'm not going to go through all of Jewish history, do it yourself. When King Solomon built the temple, when he built the temple, the Shechina rested, the first temple. In the first temple there were 10 constant miracles. Hashem's Shechina resided in the house. Inside that physical building, Hashem's presence directly existed. The night they built it, the night he completed it, on the same night that they celebrated the dedication of the Beis HaMikdash, Paroi married the daughter of Paroi. He married an Egyptian girl for certain various valid and permitted reasons. She converted. He married her. And there was something wrong about the celebration. Gemara says that the people responded to the happiness of his marriage in a proportion that wasn't correct in terms of the marriage of us and Hashem. And because of that, that night, before the night was out, his wedding night, and our wedding night, it says, Yarad HaMalach Gavriel, a certain angel came down, and he planted a staff in the Mediterranean, V'alav, it says, grew Krach Godol Shalreini, concretized around that staff that he planted in the Mediterranean, the land of Italy, Rome. Rome formed itself. Rome, which destroyed the temple. That means, you have to understand, on the night of the building of the Beis HaMikdash was generated the concrete area of the world that would come not long after and destroy it. That night. So when did we succeed? But when did we have one night that the world did what it was supposed to do? Not one. Not once. Can't avoid the subject of evil. Let's be clear here. Jews are not supposed to be a fatalist to go around looking at evil. Supposed to be very happy. It's not our subject tonight, happiness. The happiness outweighs the evil, what can I tell you? Every breath is supposed to be an ecstasy. Just being alive in the midst of the greatest suffering is supposed to be an ecstatic experience if you'd understand it properly. Maybe next week we'll talk about that. I don't know. Nutrition, things will be happier. We'll talk about it another time. Let it not be said that we come here to understand how negative Judaism is about life. But it's not that. The worst torments that the world's been through are still in ecstasy compared to not being here. I get that clear. But that's not tonight's subject. Tonight we're speaking about badness. Can't deal with everything all at once. But plenty of badness. Plenty of evil. Right? All happiness here is doomed to failure. You get used to that. There's only one kind of happiness here that's not doomed to failure. That's happiness that you send away and invest in another dimension. That's all there is to it. Any happiness you try and snatch here, the more potent it is and the more powerful you snatch it, the more it will let you down. That's what it is. Now, how did it happen? So like this. I'll tell you what it says, and then we'll try and understand. Evil is the act of bending. That's what it says. The generation of evil is the fact that creation involves this bend. Try and understand. Stay with me now. Not easy. The spiritual world is straight. What it means straight is that wherever you are, you see the beginning and you see the end. There's no corners to see around. We're trying to understand this now with a level of our minds that doesn't see in pictures. If you see it in pictures, you're lost. If you see a picture now, that's not the subject. You're lost. You have to try and elevate. We have to try and meditate now. We have to try and transcend into a level where there aren't any words or pictures. We have to unfortunately do it with words. But we have to push ourselves up there. There's a world where everything is straight. There's no possibility of making a mistake up there. Evil couldn't begin there because you never could get lost. You know, that remarkable thing is that the function of the Jewish people is to enter a world that's crooked and bring only straightness. You know that? You see, up there it's easy. There's no challenge up there. In that dimension where everything flows from beginning to end, there's no problem. The problem is when you get into the crooked world where you can't see 1 meter in front of your nose, to make straight there where there's only bends, that's very difficult. That's what the Jewish people have to do. That means don't expect to do it without resistance. Every drop, every step of the way is only resistance. You know, the world, in case you think I'm being poetic over here, the name of the Jewish people is Yisrael. Yisrael. You know what that word spells? Yashar Kael. Spell it out. Yashar Kael, the straight one of Hashem. That's our name. Yisrael. Spell it out. Yashar Kael. The ones who go straight for Hashem. And if you think it's accidental, again, what's the other name of the Jewish people? Yeshurun. Yeshurun. That's what we call that. That's Yeshurun. Yeshurun spells Yashar Nun. Straight to the 50th dimension of transcendence. That's what we are. That's what the Jewish people is. We put into a world that's only crooked, and we're supposed to be straight. The word Bereishis, by the way. Bereishis contains the letters of the word Yashar. Because Bereishis, which means when everything began, and Bereishis is a big bend, because it starts with a base. Aleph is the letter of straightness. Aleph is the letter of Aleph, of Aluf, of elevation. That's Aleph. It's silent. It can't even be in the world. Aleph doesn't have a sound, because it's can't be in a crooked world. But the world doesn't start with an Aleph. Bereishis starts with a base. That's where things are fragmented already, where they've bent already, they're broken down. In the word Bereishis is a Yashar, a straightness from there to the end. The whole point of making a beginning is to get to the end. Nobody starts any project. The only time anyone ever starts a project is when he has the end point in mind. Is that right? Nobody starts a project on nothing better to do, so he does something without thinking. The concept of doing something purposeful means that what you start with is what you finish with. Is that right? So it's ma'aseh v'machshava tchila. When an artist begins something, when an architect begins to build, when a builder begins, the first brick he puts down is only the first step towards what he already has as a conception of completeness. But otherwise it'll end up as nothing. So when Hashem does Bereishis, when Hashem begins the first letter of the Torah, he's going straight towards where he wants. The problem is he has to get there, he has to get us there, straight through a very, very crooked and torturous obstacle course. Now, that's the concept of straightness. So the spiritual world is straight. The physical world is a bend of the spiritual world, which means this. If you want to make it a very crude analogy, it would be like this. Imagine a world of straightness. What you do then is you bend that world, bend it down, that's what it says, until it crystallizes as this world. What's the result of the bend? The best example I can give you is this. It's a marshal, it's an analogy, but it's very, very, very clear. This is how they put it. I heard this from a very great man. He said the following thing. When you're walking along a straight road, from the point you began to the point of your destination, there's one unique characteristic of a straight road. And that is, you can never forget where you came from. You can never lose home. Because all you have to do when you're pushing ahead, no matter how difficult, look over your shoulder, you'll see home. You can never get lost. But when the road bends, when there's a fork in the road, after you've turned the fork, you're in big trouble. Because whenever you want to see where you came from and you look back, you will only see a fork in the road. All you'll see, the furthest you'll ever be able to see, will be a meaningless beginning. You'll see something that has no meaning. You'll see a thing that isn't a beginning. You can't see round corners. The only way you'll ever get to the spiritual source is with what can see round corners, and that's inside. But when you hear what's going on, it means that when you look at the physical world, you won't see the source. When you look at the physical world, you won't see Hashem. You won't see a spiritual world. You can't see a spiritual world. It's designed that way. The only way you can ever see the spiritual is if you look through, you look around the corner. You have to look through the physical world. You have to look back to the source that can't be seen with the physical eyes. But that's the whole idea. That's what it's built for. That's what it means the world's been bent. Now, what's it got to do with evil? As follows. Here is the idea. This is the core of the idea of how evil arises. Hashem doesn't create evil. There's nothing evil about a bend. There's nothing evil about a bent road or a straight road. Nothing good or evil about the two roads. They both get you where you're going. If the road goes straight from here to there, you get from here to there. If the road bends from here to there, you go from here to there, you get there. There's no difference. Intrinsically, the way Hashem makes it isn't good or bad. The difference is this, that when He makes a straight world, you cannot possibly go wrong. When He makes a bent world, you can possibly go wrong. But you don't have to. He doesn't make wrongness. He makes the possibility of it. Very clearly. From now on in, it's up to you. If you remember that you turned a corner, if you can bring yourself to that level of meditational insight, and you can do it through study, through Torah study, many other techniques that a person works on himself, a person can develop a memory. Can develop a memory. That's a Jewish obligation. Mitzvahs that we have to remember. Zikaron. 6 remembrances you have to do every day. Right? Zachor. Remember this. Right? Laman Tisko. You have to remember that. Remember. You have to remember that you stood at Sinai. That's what you're supposed to do. Remember it. How can you remember it? You never were there. Jewish obligation, you have to remember it. In case you think memory is a crude version of what your imagination throws up in your mind from what you once experienced, that's only the most superficial aspect of a very deep spiritual work. You have to remember Sinai. In fact, standing at Sinai, when the world was straight for an instant, you have to remember it so powerfully that the Torah doesn't even say remember it. It says don't forget. You know that? Other remembrances in the Torah, it says Laman Tizkor is this, Laman Tizkor is that. Look in the Siddur in the morning after the davening. There's 6 remembrances that you should remember every day. Of the 6 things that you have to remember, it says in order that you remember or that you remember. The one about Matan Torah, when we came closest to the kiss, when we stood making direct contact with Hashem, that kiss that it says that was sweeter than wine, at that moment it says, doesn't say remember, it says don't forget. That means the memory there has to be so intense that it's so with you all the time. It's just the guard against forgetting. The Torah doesn't ask anything impossible. The Torah doesn't ask you to remember something that you've never experienced that's impossible. You can experience it. But it takes work. You have to learn to see around corners. Nobody said the spiritual mastery is easy. You don't buy it cheap, like they sell everything instant and cheap in this generation. It's hard. It takes a lifetime. But that's what we're here for. That's the challenge. If you want to know the function of memory, the Hebrew word for memory, zecher, is also the Hebrew word for the male, for a man. Zachar. What's the connection between them being a man and remembering? A minute's thought will show you. The difference between a man and a woman is that a woman is not the function of memory. Listen well. A woman takes what's real in the world, but not yet alive, and she makes it alive. Is that right? A woman takes from a man something that couldn't possibly live, and she nurtures it into a life. That's what she does. That's her job. But what does a man do? A man could never do that. A man brings from a world that is not into a world that is. A man brings from around the corner. Is that right? A man brings into existence a seed that wasn't there before. What is the seed that the man brings into the world? What is the seed of a tree or a plant or a human? It's a condensation, a distillation of the essence of the person. Only a man can do that. Are you with me? a man brings into existence a flesh of something that is... Do you know what the seed... Do you know what the mystics say? Do you know what the seed is that a man gives? It's his memory of his father. What he got given that made him, he condenses into a flash of memory and he passes on that memory. That's what it is. In fact, if you work it out, you'll see that the Hebrew word for zera, which is a seed, adds up to the same number as zikaron, which means a memory. Right? Exactly the same thing. Seed and memory, the same thing. That's why male and memory are the same. That's what it means. But you have to live into that. You have to go back into that dimension. You have to be able to go.
The world doesn't show its source. The world arrives after the bend. You'll never see the source. Not here, only here. That's the way the world's built. Now the question is this: are you going to do that or aren't you going to do that? If you do that, you've kept the world going straight. You've made no difference to the bend. You've made the bend make no difference. If you've seen around the bend, then you know where you came from, you know where you're going. So there's no difference to the world that a bend happened. But if you choose not to see, and it's much easier than yes seeing, if you choose not to see, so you'll see, not only will you see a false beginning, you'll see no beginning at all. You'll see back to a beginning that's nothing. It couldn't be more meaningless. It doesn't say Hashem creates the world with a false beginning. No. He simply bends the right beginning so that when you look back to the bend, you see nothing. If you look at modern cosmology and cosmogony, the massive argument how the world began. So the two theories are, either it always was, that answers the question by the way, that in their mind answers the question, it always was, not a problem. Or else, it began as something that was something else. Was something else, it was very small, that's what it was. It was infinitely small if you want to know. That explains it much better. That's how it was, and then it became this. By definition, the only options are meaningless beginning. But it has to be that way. The whole thing, the whole trick, the whole purpose of creation is whether you're going to see it that way or not. That's what evil is. When you choose to see it wrong, you see meaningless beginnings. You see man as a meaningless being. He's an accidental monkey. It doesn't have any intrinsic meaning to his life. But that's up to you to see that way. You know, when you look at a human being, there are two clear-cut options. If you want, you can see a gorilla. Unfortunately, these days, people are making it much easier. Today, it takes a lot of insight to see through that, unfortunately. But if you ever get close to anybody who's reached any dimension of being human, so then it's much easier. You have a choice. Depends where you look. Depends where you look. There were Torah leaders in the last generation who said that if Darwin would ever have seen the Chofetz Chaim, he never would have said what he said. If he had ever laid eyes, I know people who saw the Chofetz Chaim. I know people personally who saw the Chofetz Chaim. And they tell me that if you ever laid eyes on the Chofetz Chaim once, you were never the same again. And I'm talking about people who are very hard to impress. I'm talking about people whom if you would see, you wouldn't be the same again. I'm not the same since I've met those people. And they tell me that when they laid eyes on the Chofetz Chaim, and these are people who are very hard to impress, they were never the same again. Had Darwin ever seen him, he never could have said what he said. But it's up to you. If you look here, you'll see this. If you look there, you'll see that. It's up to you. You want to think about things and think that there might be a corner and think what's around it, so you'll think. If you don't want to think, you'll see meaninglessness. That's the way it is. It means Hashem doesn't create evil. He creates a blind, that's all. He creates something that can be seen in two ways. If you keep it going straight from beginning to end, so then you've eliminated the bend and there's no evil in the world. There is no evil in the world. That's what it means that we are witnesses. A witness is to something that you don't see. It says we are Hashem's witnesses, Atem Adai. Nobody ever brings in a witness for something you can see yourself. Is that right? Nobody calls into the courtroom a witness for what everybody can see. A witness is for something you can't see now. It means we are Hashem's witnesses for what the world can't see right now. You look at the world, it looks like a physical place where you can do what you want, whatever kind of butchery you want. You can do that in the world because nothing to stop you. Makes no difference. You can see that. But the world's got witnesses, got us. We're the people who undergo that butchery on the receiving end in order to show that it's not the way it looks at first sight. Nothing's what it looks like at first sight. First sight's always wrong. What you see first is always wrong. Only what you see second and again and again and after that could possibly be right. What you see superficially, definitely wrong, the way the world's set up now. That's what it means. And that's the understanding of these things. A mate, a stick, a staff, means the source of bending. That's what it means. Mate means, you know, it means a staff. But it also means a tribe. You know what it means, a tribe? Do you know what the word mate means literally? It means a branch. That's what it means. You know what a branch is? Where the trunk of the tree branches off. That's what it means. The trunk is straight. Inside the trunk is everything. You can't miss whatever any leaf or fruit will receive in the tree goes through the trunk. You can't miss it. It has to go through there. When it's suckled and absorbed from the ground, it goes through the trunk. The problem is when you hit a branch. Because a branch is only a piece of the picture. If you look at the branch, you miss the whole thing. You could miss the whole thing. So when you branch off to the side, that was the power. That's why he held in his hand a branch. That's a mate. He held in his hand what Moshe Rabbeinu, you have to understand, what Moshe Rabbeinu walked around holding wasn't a piece of wood. He held in his hand the point where the world transitions from spiritual to physical. He held that power in his hand. And that's why that object was able to change the world from one form to another. When he took that object and held it out in one position, the sea split. The world changed itself. Water became blood. All kinds of things happened. Because he was holding in his hand the power of creation. The whole world is created by the act of bending. There is no sea or water or blood or any other physical object in the world of straightness. Those objects only exist in the world that's been bent. Moshe Rabbeinu held in his hand, if you understand that. He was so close to the source that he held in his hand the embodiment of the... He held the point of transition from infinite straightness into the bent world of physical objects. When you hold that in your hand, so you could make anything happen. And of course it doesn't take much to understand, that's what a shevet is. A tribe is where the father branches into a son. There are 12 tribes in the Jewish people, is that right? The trunk is Yaakov Avinu. The oneness, the 13. 13 is always one. 13 is always one. In Hebrew, the word echad adds up to 13, did you know that? The word echad in Hebrew doesn't add up to one, it adds up to 13. Add up the letters of echad, you get 13. 13 is always one, that's why there are 13 articles of faith, because there's only one article of faith. It's always like that. That's why there are 12 tribes in the Jewish people. 12 tribes embodied in the trunk of the Father. That's the 13 elements that always make up the unity of existence. That's how we witness it. We show that what looks like branches, by the way, the redemption will only come when all 12 branches of the Jewish people become one. It can't come before that. As long as we split, as long as we split in ourselves, we're never going to see any spiritual light. Because as long as we split, so the world sees the branch, they don't see the source. The first revelation, you have to understand well, the first revelation the world will have of any higher value, the first thing they'll see is the unity of the Jewish people. No question about it. Because only when you put together the branches and show oneness, so then people begin to see the straightness. But while we split up in ourselves, and by the way, if you want to know, the place where the oneness will come from is from women. Because it's a woman's power to put together different elements. A woman can bond, a man can break away. That's a tragedy of what it means to be a man. He knows how to break away and break things up. A woman knows how to bond things together, just that women have lost the confidence that they know how to do it anymore. The women are letting us down. The redemption always came from them. We never managed. The men never managed. In Egypt they gave up, it says. Men gave up. They were tortured into submission. But the women, under the pressure of that torture, they lifted the men to redemption. In every generation the redemption came from women. But the reason for it spiritually is that a woman knows how to bond. She knows how to put disparate elements into oneness and make it alive. That's how it begins. The trunk of the oneness of the Father, when he branches out into a son. One son's incomplete. One of the 12 sons of the Jewish people is incomplete totally. He's only one function, one faculty of the Jewish people. When he gets together with the 11 others and he makes a oneness, then he represents what the Father was in oneness. Those are the 13 elements of perfection. That's why the tribes are called branches. And it couldn't be clearer. Couldn't be clearer. That's why a shevet means a branch and a mateh means a branch. So what happened? Let's understand. Moshe Rabbeinu takes in his hand a staff. Hashem says to him, from now, I don't think I even need to speak it out. You should be able to work it out now for yourself. Why is the staff the source of evil? Why is that staff, which is the highest point of physical reality, when you hold that staff in your hand, you can recreate the world. That same staff is the creation of an evil so deep that Moshe Rabbeinu cannot stand and face it. While speaking to Hashem, he can't face that evil. Why? Because when you stand at the point of the bend, that's the source of evil. But it couldn't be more obvious. So what happens is he holds in his hand a staff. That staff reshapes the world. But when he throws it down on the ground and it manifests as evil,
It is so frightening. Evil's unreal. Just a bend in the road. That's all. Just a bend in the road. But it's terrifying. Because you're lost. When you turn around and you don't see home anymore, you see nothingness. You don't even see a road. You see a point of non-being. That's death. That's what death is. That's the terror and the fear of death. That's what you see. That's what evil is, death. Moshe Rabbeinu holds in his hand the source of life, and of course it's the source of death. Vayomas miponov, he fled from it. He fled in terror. What does Hashem say to him? How do you handle evil? How do you handle it? How do you bring it back to what it should be? You run away from it? Hashem says no. Walk up to it and pick it up by its tail. If you think the terror of facing it, of being in its presence is great, can you imagine the experience of having to pick it up by its tail? What it means picking up means picking it up as if it's a star. If you relate to it as a serpent, that's what it is. It's lethal beyond all belief. It's not a game. That bend in the road is real. You're lost. I'm not going to get home ever. You relate to it as a serpent. Hashem tells us what he's teaching Moshe about. You relate to it as what it looks like now, you're finished. The only way to handle it is to walk into the source of evil and pick it up as if it's reality, as if it's life. You have to handle death as if it's life. That's what a Jew is expected to do. We start with death. We start with Yitzhak, who was offered as a sacrifice on the altar. That's our story. We start after death's finished is where we begin. Not like other people. That's what a Jew begins. Death doesn't mean anything to us. We start there only. Moshe Rabbeinu picked it up, ignoring the fact that it looked terrifying. He picked it up as if it was reality, and it became reality. Then he understood he had a power. That's something that you can impress Paro with. You understand? That is something to go into the source. Where was Moshe Rabbeinu going? He was going into the core of evil. Egypt was the most wicked, negative dimension imaginable. They were the embodiment of evil. They were the most perverse and perverted people imaginable. The Torah calls it Ervas Haaretz. It means the nakedness of the world. It means much worse than I want to say the word. It means the real nakedness of the world. That's what Egypt is called. The miracle of Egypt is that Hashem himself could appear in a place of such intense evil, such intense perverseness. Moshe Rabbeinu is about to walk into the dimension of evil and to a king of that dimension. He's about to come face to face with the power of blackness, what generates evil in the world. That's exactly what he needs. He needs to hold in his hand, you with me? He needs to hold in his hand the force that is the force of creation and the force of the creation of evil. That's what it is. So you have to understand, not like a six-year-old. He walks in there and he throws his stick on the ground. And it's like a magic show. It's like a magic show. You know these shops on the corner where you can buy this, put it in your machine and you sit there hypnotized without a thought in your head. The next half an hour, and they show you that kind of thing. He tries to impress him. He puts on a show. You know, it could have been fireworks. He could have pulled a hanky out of his thing or a rabbit out of his ear. But what he did, he threw a stick on the ground. And then they did the same, and they laugh at each other, and then they do it better, and then the kids do it. You know, and then he finally pulls out the big one. His stick swallows it. That's not Torah. That's not what Torah is about. What it means is, he walks into the dimension of evil, holding control over that which is the transition from good to evil, which is exactly what Egypt has converted. Instead of choosing to see the source, they've chosen to see only the fork in the road. Which means you can do what you want. Pharaoh said, who's Hashem? I don't know him. What do you mean Hashem sent you to let the people go? I don't know who that is. I run the show. I created things. What do you mean Hashem? I made me. I made the Nile. I made Egypt. And I made me. So who's this Hashem? That's what he said to Moshe Rabbeinu. So Moshe Rabbeinu showed who he was. He said, what he was saying, the conversation. You have to understand the conversation. These were very great people. These people had to spell it out for each other. Moshe Rabbeinu showed him. He took the power that generates good and bad. And he demonstrated to Pharaoh. He showed him, what you're doing, you're seeing the black and evil you're bringing into the world, the black and evil force, where you should be bringing goodness into the world. That's your perverseness. That's your guilt. He showed him that. Pharaoh said, you're trying to impress me with that? We invented that. You're trying to chastise me with that? That's what I'm here for. And he proceeded to do it through the length and breadth of the country. The men did it, the women did it, the children did it. That's exactly the point. He was showing him that you've walked into the source of this. You walked into where this thing shows itself only as evil. And of course, that's why Aaron's staff swallowed theirs while it was a staff. That's exactly the point. He didn't swallow them up. Why does the Torah have to tell you? You have to understand. Why do we need a miracle within a miracle? It wouldn't have been impressive enough. Here are all these reptiles, right? These ferocious, lethal, terrifying reptiles. Aaron's reptile comes along and it swallows all of them up. That's pretty impressive. That's a pretty impressive demonstration that we got a higher level of voodoo than they have. But no, first it has to turn into a stick. Now, if Hashem can show miracles like that, are we going to be more impressed because he does one extra degree of miracle? Is a Jew going to be now more impressed when he reads Chumash? Because Hashem managed to do a miracle that's a little bit... That's not the point. The point is that's exactly what happened. It first had to show itself as what it really is, the transition between the source and creation, and in that form it destroys evil. It's obvious. Automatically it swallowed them up. Because when the reality reveals itself in the dimension of evil, evil disappears. That's the story. That's the story. That's what the Parsha, that's what the Seder is telling us about evil. What it means is, first of all, to understand with a little more sensitivity what it means when you read, when you learn some Torah. And if you're going to read the superficial meaning of the words, the way you were taught by some anti-Semitic Kaiser teacher when you were six, then... none of us understood. So who was able to teach anyone else? So we grew up with that idea, so we're never going to generate any spiritual depth out of that. But a person understands how to read a little bit deeper, and how to see a source idea, and how to see what the words are actually telling you, quite openly. This is not imaginative thinking over here, speculation. The words say it exactly. Try to prove it by looking at the words, looking at the events. Couldn't be understood any other way, that's what it is. The message is this, that it depends how we look at the world and how we show the world to everyone else. That's the message we have to understand. It's a life or death matter now. It's not just another Monday night. It's not just another time that we come to learn some Torah. Learning Torah puts a tremendous merit into the world. A tremendous merit, especially for the men. The men are sitting here tonight. You take this as Torah. That should put out a spiritual force into the world. Who knows what damage it can avert? Who knows if it wasn't our Tehillim, our Davening, that averted certain death for many, many people. You know, people were trapped in a situation where it was death one way or the other. I hope you're aware of that. People were trapped in a situation where they couldn't take shelter. Do you know that? They didn't know what kind... Are you all aware of this? You know that gas sinks. Do you know that? Do you know that poison gas sinks? It doesn't rise. It's designed to sink. You know that? Because if it rose, it would rise above the ground and not harm anyone. It's designed heavier than air, so it sinks. Why do you think people didn't take shelter in bomb shelters? Isn't that the natural place to take shelter? Why do you tape up a room in your house and not use the bomb shelter? Because the bomb shelter collects the poison gas. The gas sinks to the lowest point of the house or the building. That's where it's most lethal. So you can't take shelter there. You have to stay in your house. But if it's not gas, if it's conventional, you're dead in your house. And you don't know which one it's going to be. Do you hear what Hashem's doing to us? Do you hear how he's making it impossible to rely on any physical protection at all? The message couldn't be clearer. Did he have to have some maniac think up poison gas? The message couldn't be clearer. That's why there was plenty of warning, plenty of time, plenty of announcements what it meant. And then he shows us miracles. He puts us in a situation where we can't help ourselves. He catches us unawares. Instead of hiding in the place that will protect you against that particular kind of destruction, he makes you hide very vulnerable to it, and then he saves you by a miracle. A Jew has to be blind not to see these things. But we have to keep it going that way. But that rests on our merits. And we have to not stand in the way of miracles. We're no longer on the level where we can pick up the thing by its tail. We can't do that anymore. Unfortunately, the mystics of the latest generation say we can't do that anymore. Moshe Rabbeinu had that job. Shlomo Melech had that job. David HaMelech had that job. Adam Rishon, we don't have that job. Our job is just not to get in the way. That's what they say. Just don't get in the way. Hashem will do it. We don't have anything to do anymore. We're not able to do it anymore. But we mustn't get in the way. He's trying to show us. But it couldn't be more obvious how he's trying to show us. And we keep trying to get in the way. That's the job. The job is to work on ourselves where we're supposed to be working on ourselves. We're supposed to be working on davening. We're supposed to be working on Lashon Hara. That's what we're supposed to be doing.